It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is the New York Times bestselling science writer Mary Roach. In her book, Stiff, in 2003, she explored the curious lives of human cadavers. In Spook, that was in 2005, she wrote about the afterlife. In Bonk, that's 2008, about the science of sex. In Packing for Mars, in 2010, about the life in the void. And in Gulp, in 2013, about consuming food. Her latest book is titled Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And in this book, she explores the aspects of war that really don't make it into the movies, the quirky but essential science behind staying alive in combat. Mary Roach joins us for the hour via phone. Mary, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Let's reach out to our listeners. If you have questions for Mary Roach, we know there are a lot of Mary Roach fans out there. 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org, or email, tweet us at IPRTalk, or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Perhaps you're a member of the military or a former member, and you'd like to ask about a problem you've encountered during your time serving in the military that involves the science of combat. 1-866-780-9100. Mary, if we could, so many fascinating aspects of this book, but if we could start with the gear and the clothing that you dwell into in this book. First of all, make us aware of how much gear a soldier, say, on patrol in Afghanistan may have to wear.
Sure. You're talking about a load of, you know, 100 pounds thereabouts. I mean, depends on the vagaries of the mission and, you know, how big you are, how much the weight is. But you may be carrying 100 pounds. And the body armor itself is 30-some pounds. And this is stuff that you're carrying and wearing in, lately anyway, 120 sometimes degree heat, and body armor is not terribly breathable. So a tremendous amount of work goes into figuring out, you know, the systems and that you're wearing, you know, because the uniform now is sort of a system for holding these various pieces of equipment and the batteries that these new equipment may require, and you've got just the uniform itself needs to be flame resistant. You know, you need to buy the person a few seconds to get away from, you know, in the case of an explosion or fire, you know, you want it to be flame resistant as much as possible. But you know, if you go make something thoroughly flame resistant to the, you know, the extent that like firefighters wear, then it's really hot. That's not breathable. So it'd be very clammy and uncomfortable. So, you know, there's that to worry about. You also want a uniform to be, depending on what you're doing, some of the uniforms have this amazing ability to just shed whatever lands on them. In the case of a chemical attack, whatever it is would sort of bead up and roll off. So they're sort of super shedding, they call it. But that technology needs to work well with the flame resistance technology, and that needs to work with the mosquito repellent technology, and it needs to be breathable and comfortable, and it needs to come in under budget, and you have to be able to print camouflage on it. And so it's a tremendously complicated undertaking, plus little things that you would never think about, like Velcro. Yeah, Velcro's kind of great, but it's noisy. And if you need to maintain stealth, you don't want something that's going to go when you open, when you, you know, take something off or attach something. So you that's not great. Also, Velcro, if you're, say, you're a sniper and you spend time on lying face down, the dirt and debris can get into either Velcro or a zipper. And then it doesn't work. So their uniforms, the top has a side closure so that you're not lying on whatever it is. And also they put pockets on the upper arms, so rather than the chest, because if you need to get something out of your pocket and you're lying on your belly, that would be inconvenient. So there's just these considerations that you never really, I mean, unless you are a sniper, You don't really think about these things.
Right, right. Everybody will think about that the next time they have the Velcro shoes or the Velcro clothes to their clothing opened and closed. It does make a lot of noise. Now, recently, I'm sure you covered this, or you're aware of this, that the U.S. Senate approved a bill that would, for the first time, require young women to register for the draft. And then earlier this year, Defense Secretary Ash Carter announced that the military would open all combat jobs, from infantry to special operations forces to women. When you look, you're now very aware of what goes into clothing, how much thinking, how much technology innovation goes into it. Do any things spring to mind that would have to do with gender that would have to be taken account of in military clothing?
Well, yeah, just the basic Army combat uniform. The idea was for a long time, this is a unisex. This is one size fits all, but it was one size doesn't fit a lot of people, and particularly women. The uniform on women, the shoulders were often too big. It was too big in the waist. It was too small in the hips. The knee pad, the protection around the knees would tend to hit mid shin. So there were a lot of problems with the whole one size fits all. So now there is a women's uniform, but at the time I was visiting Natick Labs, they weren't calling it the female combat uniform. They were calling it the alternate, because some of the men actually found, some of the smaller stature men were finding that this fit them better, so they were wearing the quote-unquote female uniform, and so as to not, expose them to any ridicule for wearing a girl's uniform. They were calling it the ACU-A, Army Combat Uniform Alternate.
It's often, from older generations of veterans, how ill-fitting boots were and so forth. Is the military, the people who produce this, are they getting better about comfort in clothing and shoes and so forth?
Yeah, the issue tends to be, whether it's uniforms or vehicles or what have you, you go into a conflict with the equipment you had from the last conflict or war, and often that doesn't help. It's not what you need. To go from from World War II to Vietnam. I mean, suddenly Vietnam, you're dealing with this extreme humidity. I mean, some of the places in World War II were humid and tropical, but not just the extent that it was in Vietnam. Just the mildew and the skin problems and all of these things that hadn't been so much of an issue, and now going into the Middle East where it's dry and extreme heat, and you just have a completely different set of challenges, and everything you just have to rejigger everything, and it becomes the most critical thing, of course, is the vehicles, sending Humvees into Iraq, which were they fine for rifle fire, but not for RPGs. And then IEDs started showing up. And first they were on the roadside, and then the insurgents started burying them underneath, because you put the armor on the side to try to block the stuff coming from the side of the road, and then they put it underneath. And they can change their tactics quickly, but it's not easy to quickly up armor or replace vehicles that are carrying personnel. So.
I wanted to go further into vehicles in just a moment, but back up just a moment to clothing.
Sure.
You write about the challenge, as you refer to, of something we know well here in Iowa during these summer months, sweat. Talk a little bit about the challenge of clothing, dealing with sweat. Those of us who are in Iowa who have ridden across Iowa on something called Ragbri. I don't know if you know about that, Mary Roach. This is in the middle of...
My husband did Ragbri.
Did he? So he...
Yeah.
Well, what did he report about? Did he get a nice warm year to sweat a lot?
He did indeed. It was quite hot. Yeah, he talked about not so much sweat being the problem, but the seat being very painful. But anyway.
Yes. Oh, yes. That's the number one. That is the number one concern. We need the Pentagon on that one, I think, somehow to design something like that. Well, maybe you'll do it some year. Hopefully you will come out to Iowa and do that. But talk a little bit more about the complication that sweat gives us when you're in Afghanistan or Iraq, a very hot place.
Well, sweat. Ironically, sweat is your friend in a place like that. I mean, sweat is how the body keeps itself cool. It keeps itself in the temperature range that it needs to be to function properly. You know, like any medical or complex biochemical system, the body wants to be in a set temperature range. And when it starts to stray, when the temperature gets above a certain point, the body generates sweat to cool itself down. And the issue with the military is that sweat comes from plasma, which is it's the clear part of blood. And so when you're hot, your body starts shunting the blood to the skin, you know, opens up the capillaries so that you can offload the heat through sweat. It vaporizes, the heat goes into the air. But when you're working hard, your muscles need that blood. So there's this competition. The muscles of the arms and legs, when you're exerting yourself, as a soldier is doing frequently, they need the blood. But at the same time, the skin wants the blood to offload the heat. So there's not enough to go around, and you have on the mild end, you have fainting, where the blood isn't making it to the brain, and on the extreme end, heat stroke, where your body may just shut down your gut. Like, it's like something's got to give, and when that starts to happen, the consequences can be fatal. So sweat is really your friend. The military, they're not trying to prevent you from sweating. They want you to sweat. It's amazing how quickly you start to be better at sweating. Like the when troops go into the Middle East, they would sort of put them for a few days in Kuwait City. Just part of it was to acclimate. And within a few days, your body starts to sweat sooner and more copiously to help cool you down. I was in a project in the cook box at USIS, the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences. They were studying heat stroke and how to identify who might be more at risk of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they put me in with these two Army Ranger instructors, and this who have been spending time in Georgia, and they start sweating right away. And I initially took that to mean, oh, they're not in good shape or something, but it just means their body knows how to deal with heat. So and it's people who can't sweat or who don't sweat soon enough who get into trouble. And it's a problem also because of the bodybuilding supplements that soldiers and Marines are sometimes taking, because their bodybuilding is a big pastime on the bases, and those supplements can rev up the metabolism and in various ways, and proteins, you need more fluid to flush them out in the blood, so you've got a variety of complicating factors created by those supplements in these hot environments. So that's why the military is so focused on sweat and on heat and heat stroke. That's there's a whole facility over at Natick Labs that's developed that has to do with in the environmental sciences and heat, basically. How much water should you carry? Should you pre-drink beforehand? Should you, how much of it would and it just like the specifics of how can we better keep soldiers from getting heat injury, because it's a big problem.
Mm-hmm. Mary Roach is my guest. If you just joined us, New York Times bestselling science writer, her latest book in a long line of immensely interesting science books is called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. You can join our conversation 1-866-780-9100. Let's go back to the earlier point, if we could, Mary. You mentioned vehicles, and in the chapter you write about the Humvees and the Stryker vehicles. You say in the art and science of keeping people safe in a vehicle that other people are trying to blow up. So these vehicles, Humvees, Strykers, have evolved over time. Was it in Iraq or Afghanistan? The first ones showed up with even canvas doors, you said?
Some of the Humvees, yeah. The Humvee was not the right vehicle for that conflict. And the soldiers were having to, they were putting sandbags down on the floor. They were just, bolting scrap metal to the doors just to do what they could while they were waiting for the Pentagon, the military, to up-armor their vehicles or to create a new line of vehicles, which there is now, the Stryker line, but that stuff doesn't happen overnight, and people are dying every day, and it's one of the eternal challenges of war is like is you know, how do you prepare for an enemy that you haven't met yet?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, now the next generation, the Strikers have all kinds of improvements. Like the chassis is V or double V shaped rather than flat, because when you're driving over a bomb and it goes off, that energy slams straight up into this flat chassis. All of it transmits into the seats that are bolted to that floor, and then directly into the bottoms of the feet of the soldiers, and their pelvises and their spines get damaged. The heel bone, there are a lot of, they used to call it deck slap in World War One, Two, probably both, where, like, say a mine goes off underwater, the deck of the boat would slam into the heel, that fat pad, which we need because, you're walking, you're coming down with two or three times your body weight on your heel, and you need this, it's this very dense fibrous padding, and sometimes that would even explode with the chassis of the vehicle just slamming up into the feet. So now that the double V shape or the V shape deflects that energy off to the side, which helps a lot. Also, the seats are not bolted to the floor. They're almost floating. They're attached to the side or the top, and they have suspension in them to absorb some of that energy. So all of those things help tremendously with underbody blast. But the thing I reported on while I was at Aberdeen Proving Ground, there's a project called WIAMAN, which is the Warrior Injury Assessment Mannequin. It's a crash test dummy specifically for testing vehicles that are going to be driving over bombs, because an automotive crash test dummy hopefully isn't driving over.
Right.
Hopefully you and I are not driving over IEDs. The forces in a car crash are coming. It's a head-on or a side impact crash. The body's thrown forward or to the side. It's not this energy slamming into you from below. So the Pentagon has been funding this work to create a crash test dummy, essentially, for underbody blast. And that way they can evaluate these vehicles, because what happened is, contractors would send a prototype, hey, this is this great vehicle. This will keep everybody safe and alive. Well, how do you know that? And you don't want to test it in the field on soldiers. You want to know before you put people in it that this is going to protect them. And for that, you need this test dummy.
Right. And you point out, too, that often the add-ons, all the plates, add so much additional weight that you have an upper limit there, because you have to get these into the theater and right. remove them. And sometimes that's by air, right?
Well, sure. Yeah. Yeah. And also, if you add plating and protective material to a vehicle, quickly you're going to exceed the weight that the engine or the brakes can deal with. And that was happening with these past conflicts. And they start to break up the roadway. They like collapse berms.
They get heavy. Yeah. They take a real toll on the roadway there. Let's talk about some of the very interesting. You were at a repurposed movie studio near Camp Pendleton for medics training. And this was very realistic. Describe a little bit of that. They employ actors, also actors who are amputees.
Yeah, this is this place called Strategic Operations, and it used to be a movie studio. It was this guy, Stu Siegel, who made a lot of action and war movies. And at a certain point, had this idea to kind of repurpose his talent for chaos and mayhem and loud noise and gore. And he does these immersive, hyper-realistic is the terminology, trademarked, environments that groups of trainees who are going to be Navy corpsmen or combats, Navy corpsmen do the medical care for the Marines. So these medics and corpsmen would come into this environment, and they don't know what they're expecting, or hopefully they haven't been cued in. It's the scenario where they'll be walking through this. The set is an Afghan village, and suddenly firefight breaks out. And there's pyrotechnics with dust hits, so it really looks like someone's firing rifles. And there's this, they come into a room, and there might be this guy, it appears that his foot has been blown off, because there's the foot, there's a growing puddle of blood on the floor, and the amputee, it's an amputee actor who's got this latex covering on his stump and a backpack with stage blood with a pump, and the amputee actor in this case was controlling with a remote control how how fast the blood was, how fast the stump was bleeding, so that he could, you know, if the trainee was not applying the tourniquet correctly, the blood would keep coming. I mean, the level of detail is pretty amazing, and it's intense, and people are screaming, and the amputee is like grabbing the guy by the soldier, you know, grabbing the trainee by the lapels and like saying, you know, help me, get me out of here. You know, the idea is stress inoculation is the concept. And I don't know, you know, you can't ever prepare somebody for the real scenario that they're about to, you know, encounter overseas, but you can hopefully kind of give them a sense of it and prepare them a little bit, so that they'll be better equipped. Because the fight or flight response, you know, the extreme stress response, makes you fast and strong and dumb, is how they put it. It makes you can run away, climb a tree, throw a rock, which, you know, way back
when. We're built for that,
helpful.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But when you need to be cutting an emergency airway or applying medical equipment that requires you to focus and fine motor skills and decision making, all of that, you're not at your best when you're in the fight or flight mode. So I try to give them some training. They'll go through three or four or even more than that scenarios over the course of 2 days there at that set.
We have a couple minutes before we take a break, and maybe I can slip in this short email this from Slayton in Mount Vernon for Mary Roach. I enlisted in 1988 and was issued the BDU. This is the battle dress uniform, I guess, the BDU, which was the new uniform which I wore in Afghanistan in 2003 and 2004. Writes this listener, I trained the Afghan National Army. After a while, we took our uniforms to local tailors to have the best pockets moved to the arms and the spare cargo pockets added to the lower legs. That way we could use them while wearing body armor and keep them from bothering us when sitting in vehicles. We received pushback for modifying our uniforms at first until our senior leaders went on missions with it, with us. And in my 22 years, it always seems that a lot of changes are driven from the bottom up in relation to soldier comfort. It goes on a little bit, but we only have a few seconds before we take a break. So do some of these innovations come from bottom up, from what you could tell, Mary?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. And Natick Labs even, sometimes they will send personnel over to the bases just to talk to men and women about what works and what doesn't work, with the realization that, nobody knows until they've worn it. I mean, the best judges of what works are the people who are actually wearing it. So they do make an effort to do that. How successful that effort is, I can't say. But, yeah, that is absolutely right.
Mary Roach, please do stay with us for our second half hour. We're going to take a short break. New York Times bestselling science writer Mary Roach, her latest book, Grunt, is subtitled The Curious Science of Humans at War. And if you'd like to join our conversation with your question, email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook. Tweet us at IPR Talk or our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100. Ben Kiefer back with Mary Roach in just a moment. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, this hour with New York Times bestselling science writer Mary Roach. She has a new book out titled Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And in it, she explores the science of keeping us humans intact, awake, sane, uninfected, and uninfested in this bizarre and extreme circumstances we call war. Join us with your comments or questions, 1-866-780-9100. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. So many things, Mary Roach, in this book that are just fascinating to read about, especially for technology geeks. You and I in that club together, as well as many of our listeners. John from Des Moines emailed to ask, what is the coolest group of technology, the coolest group technology that you became aware of while doing your book?
Group technology?
Yeah, I'm not sure what is meant by that. Perhaps we can just broaden that out. What wowed you the most in doing this book?
Well, I'm really I'm not so much a tech writer as I'm you know, interested in the human body and all of the things it endures and how you can kind of tweak it or make it better prepared for these extreme situations. But the thing that I was amazed at was the the medical, the combat casualty care at technologies, and even some of the things that you don't really think about, like the there was the for diarrhea, which people don't really think about as a concern, historically killed 4 to 1, you know, deaths from dysentery to deaths from combat. And some of the advances with just something as seemingly simple as adding glucose to the fluids that you use to rehydrate somebody who has extreme diarrhea from food poisoning. And that just by adding glucose, you could then drink the fluid rather than get an IV. So that means you didn't have to make your way to a clinic to get rehydrated. And the number of lives saved by that is pretty amazing. I mean, The Lancet called that possibly the biggest medical advancement in terms of saving lives. Because even today, like 2.2 million, I think it is, from the WHO, deaths from diarrhea, the dehydration of diarrhea, even today. So a lot of them, you know, obviously the life-saving, the emergency trauma care work, I guess that's that really kind of impressed me the most as the in terms of technologies that have come out of combat.
You pointed out that the number one expenditure for the Veterans Administration is disability payments for hearing loss and for tinnitus. So talk about that and this technology called TCAPS, if that's the way you say it, Tactical Communication and Protective System. That's a fascinating area.
Yeah, that's a great technology. And the specific conundrum it addresses is this. Hearing loss is, I mean, the military, war is loud. You've got bombs and bullets, guns and bombs, and you've got also transportation that's very loud, helicopters or armored personnel carriers. So you know, the very loud noise is the brief exposure, but if you're, you know, exposed for 6 or more hours in a helicopter or personnel carrier, that takes a toll on hearing too. And the you know, you can certainly protect hearing with, you know, foam earplugs or those big cuffs you put over your ears, but now you've lost your ability to hear a person talking to you, or somebody yelling to get down, or a car on a driving on gravel behind you coming. You lose your situational awareness. Something like 60% of situational awareness, 50 to 60%, is from hearing. So a soldier, you know, they want to save their lives more than they want to save their hearing. So they tend not to wear the hearing protection that they're given, or you're just, you know, you're most of the time it's quiet. You know, when things go kinetic, as they say, when somebody starts shooting or something's going on, there's no way to prepare. You don't know in advance when you should put your hearing protection in, so they tend to not have it in, and then they get damage to their hearing. So TCAPS is kind of a, I tried them on. They're kind of a, it's like having bionic hearing. It does two things. It dampens the loud noise, so it protects you from the loud noise, and it amplifies, it picks up and amplifies, say, a human voice, something quiet. And so it's also got a mouthpiece so you can communicate wirelessly with someone, you know, in a helicopter or far away on the base. So you have the best of both worlds. So now that there's a reason to leave it on. You can leave it on without putting yourself in danger for missing some sort of subtle sound that's going on around you.
Mary Roach is with us, New York Times bestselling science writer. Grunt is her new book, The Curious Science of Humans at War. Let's go to sea a little bit here. We were in the heat in the first part of the show mostly. One chapter, Mary, you look at how they make and test shark repellent, whether shark repellent is even needed, what attracts sharks. Of course, this features into many stories of World War II veterans in the Pacific Theater and unfortunate situations where people are left to be rescued and are worried by a shark. So I have a personal interest in this too, Mary. I'm an open water swimmer with a group of other open water swimmers, and soon we'll be swimming in the Pacific several miles off the coast there. What are your tips for not getting eaten?
You know, setting aside for a sec the whole World War II, there's a lot of panic and concern about shark attacks because it was the first time the U.S. had been fighting over and on temperate waters and tropical waters, and so flyers and sailors were very worried about shark attack. As it turns out, the incidence was at that point rare to non-existent. It wasn't happening. But they needed to come up with something to put in the life rafts to make people feel safer. It was called Shark Chaser. But the reality is that when sharks come, if you're in a life raft at sea, and sharks will come over. But as it turns out, what these folks, the Navy, Office of Navy Research, figured out from interviewing something like 2,500 aviators whose planes had gone down, and they ended up, you know, they ditched the plane. They're in a life raft. What they realized is that the life raft provides shade, and fish gather underneath it, and the sharks are coming over to the raft to take the fish underneath. The sharks, they're interested in fish. They're not interested in you. So obviously there are incidents where a shark, particularly a great white, will come over to sort of taste you. And when a shark tastes you, that can be a fatal injury, obviously. But by and large, the risk and the panic was way overblown for the actual danger. The Navy did a ton of work, fascinating work, looking at what attracts and repels sharks: sweat, urine, blood. And the good news is that none of those things, if you're a human, particularly attract a shark. But if you are a fish, fish blood and guts, anything that suggests a fish is wounded and easy prey, a shark will make a beeline. I interviewed one guy who spent a tremendous amount of time, he's an underwater filmmaker, and I said to him, what is your best piece of advice for staying, for encountering a shark, should you encounter a shark? What's your best piece of advice? He said, enjoy the experience. In other words,
and he wasn't joking.
No, he wasn't joking. He wasn't joking. He's saying they're amazing creatures, and you're probably going to be fine. He said if you're concerned, like drop down unless it's super deep water, drop down to the bottom where you're less obvious, and they'll ignore you. So shark repellent. The shark repellent that the OSS in World War II, precursor to the CIA, the OSS tested hundreds of compounds as potential shark repellents. In the end, what they put in it was 80 or 90% of it was just a black dye that would create a cloud that you could sort of hide in, similar to what a squid or octopus would do.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, they didn't find any compound that, and the other problem is you're putting it into an ocean, so it's going to dilute really quickly to the point where
The point here, too, that sharks are looking for very specific scents associated with their normal prey, and humans are not their normal prey, so they tend to ignore us.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Some of these researchers, at one point, they had a big tank, and they would introduce sharks, and they put a rat in that had a wound, and the sharks kind of ignored. They weren't interested because it's a mammal. It's not what they're interested in. But then they coated the fur with what they called mullet blend, which was, I guess, mullets and a little water in a blender. So if you put that onto a mammal and then put it in the water, now that mammal is in trouble because it smells like fish.
Yeah. So talk about another aspect at sea, a submarine escape at the U.S. Naval Submarine School in New London, Connecticut. You were there. They simulate emergencies in submarines. Now, this is something you just mentioned, being in a submarine, to some people, and people say never, not on your life. But there are some people, of course, unfortunately they do, to protect our national security, go into submarines. Tell us about their drills in the case of an emergency.
Yeah, the submarine school has a damage control trainer, which is an engine room, basically, with the various equipment that you would have in an engine room and a lot of pipes and things that you would also have. And the students go in, and a leak starts, a flange, whatever it is, ruptures. And so you have this leak, and you have to use the tools at hand to stop that leak. And then as time goes by, the water's, it's cold water, it's getting higher and higher, and bigger leaks are opening up, and there's a team of, I think it was like four people, and they're trying to use, and it was fascinating, some of the technology to stop a leak. It's stuff that was used on old wooden sailing ships, just like a pine plug, excuse me, a pine plug, because pine absorbs water and it expands. So you put a conical plug, you hammer that in, you put the pointy part in first, you hammer that in as far as it goes, and it kind of expands in the moisture and becomes a pretty good seal for a certain kind of hole. And you can also, if you've got a pipe that's leaking, you start wrapping a piece of twine or string or rope, you know, thin rope, you start just wrapping that around and strangling the leak. You know, you start at the side, you know, rather than slapping something over it, which will just be pushed away by the pressure, you kind of sneak up with it. Kind of like when you put a fire out in a wastebasket by pulling a blanket or something over the, sliding it over the top. You kind of, wrap that string around it and gradually choke off the leak. So pretty amazing.
And there was something called an escape trunk, right?
Yes, an escape trunk. If the sub is disabled, if it's sunk, or if you need to get out, there's a fire. Hopefully you can wait for rescue. Mm-hmm. If there's not a fire, if things are stabilized on the sub, you can wait for one of those deep submergence rescue. Sphere, well, they're not necessarily spheres, but anyway, they can come down, attach to the sub and rescue the people on board. But if the situation isn't stable, if there's fire, if there's the air supply is compromised and you need to get out, yeah, there's this escape trunk. And the main problem with escaping from a sub, it's like being, you know, if you're in a car and it goes into the water, the pressure holds the door shut. So you can't open the door. You would have to roll the window down and then let some water in until the pressure equalizes, and then you could open the door. Same thing with a sub, only it's a lot of pressure. And so, to push open a hatch, which you could do at the surface, you can't do that. So there's this escape trunk. Water comes in and pressure, and the pressure equalizes between the inside and the outside. You have to clear your ears, and you're wearing a suit, an escape suit that has an air supply that enables you to keep breathing. You don't want to ever hold your breath when you're coming from depth up to the top quickly, because the air expands in the lungs. So there's a training, pressurized submarine escape trainer at the base in New London, Groton there, and big, high, 37 feet. So you go in at the bottom and you are practicing. There's an escape trunk that you practice, and then you go up to the surface.
Mm-hmm. Imagine you weed out a few people who just find out they're not suited for submarine duty.
Yeah. Oh, you do. Yeah. Oh, and some people just their ears can't take it. Before you go into the escape trainer, they put you through an exercise where you have to, similar to what divers do, just clearing the ears, kind of holding the nose and pushing out that thing that you need to do to.
To equalize the pressure in your ear.
The ear thing, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of holding your nose, you write a more humorous part of the book about a stink bomb that was developed but never used. And the name of this bomb, someone had a real sense of humor, was called Who, Me?
Yeah, this was World War II. Again, the OSS, forerunner to the CIA. Who, Me? Was the brainchild of Stanley Lovell, who was the research director for the OSS. And the idea was to create a subtle and cheap little device that you could put into the hands of people in resistance groups in occupied countries, that they would then have this little stink weapon that they could have in their hand or in their pocket, and they'd sidle up to an officer and spray him with this horrible. Now, the original plan was for it to smell like a very loose bowel movement, but that was Stanley Lovell's original intent. It morphed over the years and took slightly different shades of stink. But but they were bedeviled by all kinds of backfire and dribble, storage problems. The file is quite entertaining.
Going off to work, I imagine, at one of these research. What did you do today, Dad?
Yeah, exactly.
Developed a stink bomb, and we're thinking about what really stinks and what would embarrass them. So you're embarrassing someone.
Yeah, the idea was to ostracize this person, humiliate them, embarrass them. sap their morale. You know, it varies, just subtle things when, you know, just to get people, you know, motivated civilians involved in the war effort and doing what they could. Yeah, it was a bizarre chapter in the history of World War II. NDRC, who came up with the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima, they were involved in both the stink bomb and the bomb. And it was the final report on Who Me was finished 17 days before the bomb was dropped. So it was kind of a bizarre juxtaposition of stink bomb and real bomb.
Mm-hmm. About 5 minutes left with Mary Roach. Her new book, Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. A question from Praveen, one of our listeners. How did you get interested in science writing is the question for you, Mary.
I was writing more general magazine features, and an editor from Discover Magazine wrote to me and said, would you be interested in doing some pieces for us? And I said yes, and they were always the most interesting stories I'd done, and I kind of never looked back.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to ask, what is the key to making science writing so accessible? Because there is a lot of science writing out there, often by academics, and it's, I guess, purposefully so. It serves that purpose, but it's reading that you don't really want to spend a lot of time with. Your reading pulls you in, pulls you through, and makes it accessible. How did you develop that talent?
Well, it's partly my love of travel and stepping into foreign worlds. I tend to cover things there'll be something going on, people, dialogue, conversation, something I can see and observe, rather than, you know, protein receptors and gene expression, that's tough to make that accessible and have it really draw people in. So part of it is the topics that I choose. They tend to be things that are where I can immerse myself in a scenario and describe it and kind of have a bit of narrative story to pull people along.
Mm-hmm. In this particular book, what were the biggest challenges in writing about technology, science, and war?
Well, the writing, I guess the challenge, I'm known as sort of a funny writer, and some things, you know, some things don't lend themselves to humor. There definitely are parts of the book that aren't funny, you know, because the topic isn't appropriate. It's interesting, but it's not necessarily funny. So the balance of humor and respect and making the tone consistent, even though there were definite shifts in tone, I guess that was the biggest challenge. You know, the humor tended to be, you know, the shark repellent and the stink bomb, the historical chapters, because I had a lot of correspondence from back then, so that was a little more fun and light than, say, the chapter that's at the morgue in Dover and some of the work that they do there.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Did it change the way you view our military? We, consuming the news, are used to, you know, going back decades, stories of Pentagon waste, our massive military expenditures and the waste there. Did you get a different view of it? Did it change your thinking there at all?
Yeah, the main thing is that I just don't have this sense of the military as this monolithic entity. I was spending time with scientists and researchers and medical personnel who are kind of a world unto themselves and do tremendous work that isn't wasteful. And, you know, it isn't, you know, there's a whole other military that is the decision makers and the people who are calling the shots, as it were, and you know, it's a different part of the military. So the people that I focused on, I had a tremendous amount of respect for, and I think, you know, it's nice to pull them out and give them a little credit, because they do tend to get painted with the same brush as kind of the military, the mm-hmm. wasteful killing, you know, the politics, you know, the stuff that is in the news all the time. They tend to get lumped in with that because they're military, and you know, they their work is interesting and really comes from a place of concern.
Right. We have just a few seconds left. I bet you many of us will want to know, what is the next subject you're tackling, perhaps already tackling for your next book?
I wish I knew. I really do. I don't know what the next book is yet.
Okay.
I'm open to suggestions.
Okay. Contact Mary Roach. Thank you for being with us this hour. New York Times bestselling science writer Mary Roach. Her latest book, Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. Mary Roach, thank you for spending the hour with us. We really appreciate it.
You bet. My pleasure.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Graham Bly. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can find a podcast of this program. We'll post it shortly at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet me if you'd like to suggest a discussion for a future show. Tweet me at IPRBen. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.